We got
But I'm also want to say a few things about the government of Scotland, because it's germane to an understanding of the Reformation there, also germane to understanding John Knox and what he accomplished there. He wasn't always, he never, wasn't always, he never pulled his punches, except one time I can think of that he did. But typically, he was very plain spoken, and he wasn't afraid to write it down and to publish it and to take whatever heat came from it. And some of his commentary on the ordering of civil authority came under great fire in his own day. And today, it's not even a discussable topic except at my house. So, monarchies that the Reformation in Scotland took place under are very interesting. Starting with the kings of Scotland. Now, in the 1500s, Scotland was still an independent kingdom, and it was the nation of Scotland, and they had kings, and they had a monarchy that was hereditary. And the king of Scotland at the start of that century, the start of the 1500s, in which Martin Luther and John Calvin and John Knox are going to play such a significant role, was a character named, he was James the Fourth. The kings of Scotland typically were named James for several centuries, and it just went father, son, and so there's going to be James the Fourth, James the Fifth, and James the Sixth. And in between those three Jameses is going to be Mary, Queen of Scots. And so we'll try and get them in the right order. But the one who was primarily ruling over Scotland during the time of John Knox was Mary, Queen of Scots. And so let me get us there and talk to you a little bit about John Knox and Mary, because their relationship is what is studied the most by historians, because both of them had such an impact on Scotland. James the Fourth was married to Mary Tudor. So James the Fourth of Scotland, the King of Scotland, married the sister of Henry the Eighth. Henry VIII was Henry Tudor, and the Tudor family ruled England. So Henry VIII is the one who actually brought the Reformation about in England. He never left the Catholic Church. In fact, he was declared by the Pope a prince of the Church because of his as a defender of the faith. But at the same time, because of his marital problems and his constant divorcing of his wives, or separating their heads from their shoulders, whichever method he used, he went through a number of different wives, and every time he wanted a divorce, he had to go to the Pope to get it. And finally, Henry VIII and the Pope were at odds over Henry's latest desire for a divorce. And what happened is some of the Protestant bishops of England who had been influenced by Martin Luther, they came alongside Henry and said, you have every right to get a divorce from your current queen for these following biblical reasons. And Henry said, hey, I like the way you think. And so he divorced the Pope. And so the papacy was gone in England. There were still lots of devotees of the Catholic Church, still lots of Catholics, but Henry became not just the King of England, he became the King of the Church. He declared that as King of England, he was the head of the Church. He was the head of the Church of England, the Christian Church in England. And that's another whole story that's part of the century and part of the Reformation and all that. But his sister married the King of Scotland. And the King of Scotland at that time was James IV. Now, James V was, guess what, James IV's son. And James V was only like a month and a half old when his father died. And so he became the King of Scotland, James V. And so, obviously, he really couldn't rule as the king. When a child became the king or the queen, typically the king's advisors or family influencers or whoever had political authority would choose a regent to rule in the place of the infant or the young person who isn't old enough to rule the country yet. And so we've got this month and a half old infant who is now King James V of Scotland, who, of course, doesn't know his head from a hole in the ground yet, and they appoint a regent to rule over, to take care of him, and to rule over the kingdom. And the regent that they chose for James V was his mother, which was not uncommon. And so his mother, Mary Tudor, became not the Queen of England, not the Queen of Scotland, but the Queen Regent of Scotland. She was the regent. So she raised her son and ruled in his place. And then she remarried, and James V was turned over to his second cousin, who was a nobleman, of course. John, Duke of Albany, became the ruler of Scotland. Now, he wasn't the King of Scotland. James V was King of Scotland. But his regent, his new regent, was his second cousin. And eventually, James V, I think at the age of 17, is going to become the actual King of Scotland. And that is, let's see if I have a date for that. 1528, he actually becomes the King of Scotland. And he is only going to rule from 1528 to 1542, and is going to die at the age of 30. But James V, in that brief period of time, had two children by his wife. He married the I don't remember her name. Anyway, he married and had several children, two, and one was Mary, who's going to become Mary Queen of Scots. So she's the daughter of James V. He also has seven illegitimate children by seven different women. So he's carrying on a tradition of Scottish kings also. That was commonplace for Scottish kings and was approved of by the Catholic Church. So you can see the dissatisfaction with the Catholic Church runs deep and runs right through to the crown of Scotland. So James V is not there very long. 14 years he's the king, and dies, has two legitimate children, one of whom dies, and so Mary, Queen of Scots, becomes the new queen. She becomes the Queen of England, except her problem is she's 4 years old or 5 years old, something like that. And so they appoint her mother to be the regent. Now her mother, whom I couldn't think of a second ago, is Mary Mary of Guise. So Mary Guise is French. And Mary Queen of Scots is raised in France. So she is a French speaker in a French family. Her mother is Mary Guise, who was married to James V, who has died. And so now the French are in control of the throne of Scotland. Remember I said they had a special relationship down through history, and here Mary Guise gets plugged in, and she is an arch-Catholic and is determined to make sure the Reformation does not succeed in Scotland. And she's raising her daughter, Mary, Queen of Scots, in France as a devout Roman Catholic. Well, in the meantime, John Knox has come along in Scotland, along with Wishart and Hamilton and all the other preachers that are now men who are being converted, mostly monks and friars of all different sorts, Augustinians, Dominicans. The Reformation is sweeping across Scotland, and it's sweeping across France as well. And Mary Guise is trying to beat back the Reformation wherever she has authority, and she has full authority in Scotland. Now, we know that John Knox had joined the garrison at the castle in St. Andrews, and a French fleet came and captured the castle, captured old John Knox, made him a galley slave and all of that. And that's because Mary Guise is ruling from France over Scotland. And she comes to Scotland with an army, because as the Reformation spreads, rebellion spreads in the Catholic Church. In fact, the Protestants are now dismantling the monasteries. The monasteries are the centers of wealth. Wherever the Catholic Church exists, the monasteries are in control of a great deal of the wealth of the country. So when Henry VIII in England decided to become the head of the church, monasteries, their sworn authority is to the Pope, not to the king, not to the monarch of the country. So the monasteries are how the Pope religiously controls the various countries of Europe. It's through the monks, it's through the monasteries, because they're sworn to the Pope, and he controls who the head of the monasteries are going to be. He gets to pick. He also gets to pick, in most Catholic countries, the archbishops and the bishops. So the Pope has a great deal of both religious authority and secular ruling authority, civil authority. So when Henry VIII dumps the Pope, he demands that all the monasteries swear their allegiance, all the monks swear their allegiance to him as the new head of the church. And a lot of the monks won't do it. And especially the heads of the abbeys and the guys who have control of all that wealth. And Henry VIII says, well, that's just fine. I need the money. And he sicks his nobility on the monasteries, and they take everything. And the nobles are quite happy to support the looting of the monasteries, because that's where all this wealth is. And the monasteries sit in the land that's run by aristocrats and nobles. And they're always in contention with the monasteries. There's always this tension between them, and sometimes open conflict. Well, now Henry VIII has turned his nobles loose on the monasteries, and they're just tearing them to shreds and looting them. And that money is flowing, a percentage of it's flowing into the coffers of the king. So this Reformation business is pretty profitable for the king. Well, in Scotland, the same thing starts to happen. The nobility, who now have professed to be Protestants, the Queen Regent is in France. Who cares about her? And the nobility of Scotland, as they're converted, as they become Protestants, as the Reformation is being worked out in practical ways in Scotland, the monasteries are being attacked by the nobility primarily, who's taking their land and their assets and adding it to their own wealth. And the monks can't do anything about it except appeal to the Queen Regent, who's in France. So Mary Guise sends the French army, or a contingent of the French army, to Scotland to suppress the Reformation and to reignite the monasteries, many monks of whom have now left the monastery altogether, and some of them have become Protestant preachers. These are the only educated people, remember. The men in the monasteries and the men in the universities, they're the only ones that can read and write, and they're now becoming Protestant preachers as the gospel is sweeping through Scotland, and Knox is kind of behind all of this, or most of this. He did not necessarily countenance the looting of the monasteries, but there wasn't much he could do about it because it was really the nobility who had the political power, and they saw their main opportunity and took it, which is what they're going to do all through the history of Scotland. They're going to switch sides when they need to for their own benefits, etc. I mean, these guys are robber barons when it comes to enhancing their own families and their own wealth. Even though they may have converted to Protestantism, a lot of them, it was just a matter of practicality or pragmatism on their part. But they are supporting these preachers now, and the churches are being put together. So the Calvinistic influence of Knox really predominates in the Reformation in Scotland. And as he states it, we aim at, quote, total reformation of religion in the whole realm. And he becomes the counsel to the acting civil government of Scotland that is actually on the day-to-day basis is conducting civil authority, civil government, while the Queen Regent is in France. And the Queen, who's now growing up to become Mary Queen of Scots, is maturing in France. But in the meantime, Scotland's being ruled by the nobility, and they've turned to John Knox for counsel. And so now the Reformation is being worked out in a practical way in Scotland. So the preachers are studying the scriptures, and with John Knox kind of being having the most authority among them. And he puts together a national covenant. That is a document which states clearly that Scotland is going to be a Reformed and Presbyterian nation, although it doesn't say Presbyterian. It's going to be a Reformed nation based on the Word of God, and the following things are going to be true of our country, of our nation. And in it, they include to ensure the word is truly preached, that the sacraments are rightly administered, that common prayers are publicly made, children are instructed in the chief points of religion, offenses are corrected and punished in the civil realm, abbeys, monasteries, friaries, nunneries, chapels, chantries, cathedral kirks, canonries, colleges are all going to be abolished as monuments of idolatry. So they're not going to abolish the cathedral itself, they're going to abolish the idolatry that's represented in the cathedral through images and statues and all the superstitious stuff that has been part of Scottish worship for centuries. And they're going to do away with it. Now, you can imagine that there were plenty of Catholics who were going to dig in their heels because this is a destruction of what they base their faith on. They pray to Mary. They worship at the statues in the cathedrals. And all of a sudden, these radicals, these revolutionaries, are going to tear all this stuff down. And so they're, you know, the people who are going to remain loyal to the church, loyal to Mother Church, they're appealing to the Queen Regent in France to come and stop this. And so Mary Guise sends the French army. And battles are fought across Scotland, some won by the French and some won by the Scots, Protestants. But the National Covenant has been issued. John Knox says, this is what Scotland is going to be from henceforth. And indeed, that is what it's going to be. He has to start putting ministers in the various parish churches. So he's not going to have any minister that's unqualified or inefficient. And this is a whole on a national level. So this is a very, very difficult transition time. But if you don't have a qualified minister in a particular parish, then choose a reader. Somebody who is literate and can read and will supply you with Bibles, and you'll read the scriptures and read sermons and read the literature of the Reformation that's pouring out of Europe and being translated into English or Broad Scots or whatever they're reading at the time. And church discipline is going to go where magistrates dare to, you know, fear to tread. The church is going to exercise discipline in their communities to try and cut down on the widespread sinfulness and debauchery of the culture that has been in place for centuries. Superintendents are appointed for the 10 ecclesiastical districts to ensure compliance. Itinerant ministers are going to travel around, like George Wishart, and Knox himself. They're going to travel all over Scotland and preach, establishing new parishes, new churches, and how they're going to be operated. So this is a national reformation that takes place in Scotland. And as I've said over and over, it wasn't just John Knox, but he's the one who was the spark that got it going. And he was the one they looked to for training. Remember, he trained all those preachers in Geneva, and some of them were Scots, and they're there. He's trained English preachers, and they're Puritans in England. And of course, England is changing too. Henry VIII dies, and Edward VI becomes the King of England. And, you know, after Knox has been exiled, he comes back to England rather than Scotland. He spends more time in England than he does in Scotland. But he organizes the English church too and writes the 39 Articles, or collaborates on the 39 Articles of the Anglican Church. And he becomes a close advisor to King Edward VI. So we're past that. Scott's influence on Scotland is past the time of Edward VI. And Mary Tudor has become the Queen of England in the meantime. And she becomes known as Bloody Mary because she is going to reestablish the Catholic Church, whatever it takes, and however many people she has to burn at the stake. And so Bloody Mary Tudor is running hog wild in England during the time of Knox, he's gone to Geneva at that time and is learning and training and all of that. So this is the post-Mary Tudor era also. So there's a lot of water under the bridge already in the Reformation in both England and Scotland when Knox is at the height of his powers in Scotland. And he wrote a book while he was over on the continent that has the wonderful title of The First Blast of the Trumpet Against the Monstrous Regiment of Women. And this is his most famous book because it has been pounced on over the centuries by historians, and in modern times, of course, by a monstrous regiment of women feminists who see John Knox as the ultimate devil himself in history. And what he meant by that wonderful title, The Monstrous Regiment of Women, is he was referring to the Marys that had such a deleterious influence on the Reformation. Mary Guise in Scotland, and of course it's going to be Mary Queen of Scots, yet to be determined if she's part of the monstrous regiment, and Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary in England. That's who he had in mind, is these queens who were so attached to the papacy and the Catholic Church and so devoted to the elimination of the Protestant Reformation. They were the targets of this book, this monstrous regiment of women. So it wasn't like it was women in general or women promiscuously. He had very specific monarchies in mind of women who were devoted to the destruction of the Reformation. Now, he got called on the carpet about this book by nobody, by Queen Elizabeth in England herself, who had an audience with John Knox, and the first thing she said is, "You think I'm a member of that monstrous regiment?" And she has the power in life and death over everybody that is in her presence. And there's John Knox. And he, "Oh no, I didn't have you in mind at all." He had to defend himself. So he was called on the carpet very early by the Queen of England, who is not trying to stamp out the Reformation. She's trying to call a halt to it. There's too much Reformation in England already. Let's slow down here. And she's, you know, in a negotiation stage with the Puritans, who are really taking over the Anglican Church. And she likes different aspects of the Anglican Church that are not reformed. And so she doesn't want any more Reformation in the Anglican Church. But she calls John Knox on the carpet for this monstrous regiment book. And then Mary Queen of Scots does the same thing. In their first audience, she asks him about this book that he wrote against women monarchies. And he very boldly said, "It remains to be seen, Your Majesty, if you're going to promote godliness or you're going to follow in the footsteps of your mother-in-law and or of your mother and of Mary Tudor in England, to whom she's also related." So Knox has plenty of enemies. And a price has been put on his head by Mary Guise, and he's been threatened that if he preaches at St. Giles, he will be killed while he's in the pulpit. And of course, everybody waits Sunday to see if he's going to show, and of course, he's there preaching bolder than ever, and people that have been sent to assassinate him get converted instead. And wherever he goes, it's like he's under some sort of divine protection, even though there are hitmen out looking for him, sent by various Catholic civil authorities. I'll read to you a couple things by Knox. A little bit about his first audience with Mary. Mary finally becomes the Queen of Scotland, and she brings her own priests with her from France, and she sets up a Catholic chapel at Holyrood, which is the Queen's palace in Edinburgh. And so she has her own chaplains, and they celebrate the Mass, which is illegal in Scotland. And these are the first things that she does. She does the very things that Scotland is already sworn to oppose to. And so she calls for John Knox. She wants to have an audience with him to see if they can straighten out any differences they might possess. And she's a teenager. You know, she's 17 or 18 years old. She's beautiful, redheaded, very Scottish, but also very French and very Catholic. And so she's going to face the great John Knox in their first encounter. And he records it in his History of the Reformation in Scotland. Let's see if I can find that dialogue here. It's almost humorous. Well, it is humorous. Now, wasn't then. Where is it? Scotland welcomed Mary, by the way, with open arms and with celebrations and parades and balls and parties. She was welcomed by the nobility of Scotland, most of whom had become Protestant, but they're very much desirous of true authority and of the right monarchy over them. And she is it. She is the legitimate legal Queen of Scotland, and they are thrilled and excited about the possibilities. Now that Mary Guise is gone, and they have great expectations. Let's see. The Queen accused John Knox, when he finally meets her at Holyrood, that he had raised a part of her subjects against her mother and against herself. He had written a book against her just authority. She meant the treatise against the regiment of women, which she should cause the most learned of Europe to write against, that he was the cause of great sedition and great slaughter in England, and that it was said to her that all which he did was by necromancy. So she's been told that he is a necromancer, and those are people that handle snakes and make prophecies and believe in direct revelation and things like that. To the whole of which John answered, "Madam, may it please your majesty patiently to hear my simple answers. First, if to teach the truth of God in sincerity is to rebuke idolatry and to will a people to worship God according to his word, be to raise subjects against their princes, then can I not be excused?" In other words, I have preached the word of God faithfully, and if that's what you're calling sedition against the prince or against yourself, I'm guilty, as that's what I have done. "For it hath pleased God of his mercy to make me one among many to disclose unto this realm the vanity of the papistical religion," that is papal religion, the Catholic Church, "and the deceit, pride, and tyranny of that Roman Antichrist, whom she loves and adores, the Pope. But, madam, if the true knowledge of God and his right to worshiping be the chief causes that must move their just princes, as it is most certain they are, wherein can I be reprehended? I am surely persuaded that your grace has had and presently has as unfeigned obedience of such as profess Jesus Christ within this realm as ever your father or other progenitors had of those who were called bishops. And touching that book which seemeth so highly to offend your majesty, it is most certain that I wrote it, and I am content that all the learned of the world judge of it. I hear that an Englishman hath written against it, but I have not read him. If he hath sufficiently improved or disproved my reasons and established his contrary propositions with as evident testimonies as I have done mine, I shall not be obstinate, but shall confess my error and ignorance." In other words, I stand by what I wrote, but if you can prove me wrong using the evidence that I used in my argument, I'm prepared to recant it. She says, "You think then that I have no just authority?" He says, "Please your majesty, learned men in all ages have had their judgments free. They've most commonly disagreed from the common judgment of the world. Such also have they published both with pen and tongue, and yet notwithstanding they themselves have lived in common society with others and have borne patiently." And then he goes on to quote Plato and others who wrote on civil authority. And he says, My hope is that so long as you defile not your hands with the blood of the saints of God, neither I nor that book shall either hurt you or your authority. In very deed, madam, that book was written, and most especially against that wicked Jezebel of England. Of course, Queen Mary Tudor. And then Queen Mary of Scotland says, but ye speak of women in general? Most true, madam, yet it appeareth to me that wisdom should persuade your grace never to raise trouble for that which to this day hath not troubled your majesty, neither in person nor yet in authority. So he reaffirms his loyalty to Queen Mary. However, if she attacks the church, like the other Marys have done, what he wrote in that book about the monstrous regimen of women stands, and he'll stand behind it. But it depends on how she is going to rule. And their interview goes on and on, and he wrote it all down afterwards, so we know exactly what was said. And it goes back and forth, her arguing with various points from his book and from what she's heard about him. And he attacks the Pope and attacks the Catholic Church and defends a biblical view of civil authority. And in the end, she says, we need to talk about this further, because she was so upset with the interview. And she could have just called her retainers and say, take this guy out and chop his head off. But she realized everything that he was saying was actually true, although she disagreed with his analysis of the Catholic Church and such that she's been brought up in. But she is no match for John Knox in theological debate, and she knows that. So she has him come back at another time, and they have another interview. And he calls her on the carpet for some of her immoral activities, which have become public knowledge. In the end, she breaks down and just cries so loud and lamentably that he has to leave. He really broke her down in that interview too. So he goes on continuing to preach, and she goes on continuing to scheme, and a lot of different things happen. She has two children by her first husband, who was Henry II of France, and one of those children she had is going to be crowned King of Scotland. He's going to be James VI. And James VI, though, in the providence of God, is also going to become the King of England. And therein lies another enormous tale that has all kinds of repercussions for Scotland and for Presbyterianism in Scotland and England. And we'll pick up with his monarchy at another time. But let me conclude by saying this about John Knox. Of course, he eventually did die. He died of disease in old age. And his house can be visited. It's about three blocks down from St. Giles Cathedral Church, the High Church of Scotland, and in Edinburgh. And he was buried behind the church. And in the 20th century, when they decided to turn the burial ground behind St. Giles into a parking lot, they paved over. And so when you go to visit the grave of Knox today, it is a parking space behind St. Giles, and it's parking space number 53 or something, I can't remember which one it is, behind the church. And it just says in the pavement of the parking lot, here lies John Knox. And of course, when he was buried,
Yeah.